On today's episode of Open Kwong Door, Elvis Stoiko.
Okay, it's rolling.
It's rolling, people.
I got nothing. I don't know what to say.
Welcome to Open... Oh, I'll start that one again. All right, Paul. Well, you know, you and I both as former skaters, we couldn't go probably 2 feet without hearing the name Elvis Stoiko. Elvis came along after I had already started coaching. And one of the things that impressed me about him was his absolute love for the sport and his athleticism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when I was skating, he was the guy that came right after sort of Kurt, and he was next in line, and he definitely brought a different style to the whole thing, which was it was interesting to watch him sort of try and figure himself out in a way, and because he was seemed like he was sort of constantly trying to sort of prove himself and prove his sort of style that he brought to it that was different. And I think it was just sort of so different that people sometimes didn't know what to make of it sometimes. So,
and that's the interesting thing. When you're a bit of a trailblazer, there are always going to be naysayers. There are always going to be people who say, oh, it should be this or it should be that. And that's really what separates the men from the boys, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you can't help but think that when Tyler Cranston arrived, there weren't people that were saying, what? Same thing with when Kurt Browning, you know, did his Casablanca program. Same thing. It was just so totally unheard of. And I think that when Elvis came along, his speed, his power, his ability to jump was second to none. And then he had this kind of creativity that he was trying to bring out as well. Very interesting, interesting man. And you know, how many times have I said this to you? I don't care who you are. If you have an opinion, I love hearing it. The ones that don't have the opinions, those are the ones that kind of I don't really trust. Yeah. So, whatever it is, if you're willing to say it, I'm willing to listen. So, this was fun for me.
Well, and it's interesting just to sort of hear about all the other different things that he does and how it all kind of revolves around his skating in a way, but he does racing and martial arts and all that kind of thing. And I remember when I was quitting skating, and I had that conversation with my coach at the time, who is a great guy named Robert O'Toole. And I remember I was really nervous about telling him that I wasn't going to keep doing this. But it was because I was so busy doing other things and learning about film and television and all
world.
This stuff. And I just remember that he was actually very almost excited and happy because he said, you've got all this other stuff that you want to pursue and want to do. And I think sometimes it's hard for people to, it's almost a vacuum after you finish skating because there's nothing to sort of, you know, you've been doing this for all these years in a skating rink and everything. But Elvis seems to have just gone from skating to one thing to another.
Yeah.
And trying to do, you know, do all this sort of just interesting stuff. So.
As I've always said, if, I love people who are willing to answer a question when it's asked. And Elvis is always willing to do that. He's always willing to go on the record with what his opinions are. I appreciate that. And I also appreciate the fact that this is a very loyal person. He gives credit where credit is due. And he has friendships that date back decades. So, ladies and gentlemen, Elvis Stoiko. Hallelujah!
It worked.
On this episode, we have a 3-time world figure skating champion, 2-time Olympic silver medalist, Lou Marsh Trophy winner. What did I say?
No, you're good.
Oh, okay.
7-time national champion. Because you asked me earlier about that.
I know, because I gave you too many or not enough.
No. 7 is good, and then you said 6, but it was okay.
Such a journalist. I make stuff up. Anyway, I'm delighted to have Elvis Stoiko. Elvis, thank you for talking to me. What people don't know is we're sitting here in a hotel room after a long rehearsal for a great show in Peterborough. You're very tired. I am too, but you're willing to do this. What a sport.
No problem. It's all good.
So I want to find out, tell me about little Elvis. Mm-hmm. Tell me about when you were a little kid. What kind of little kid were you?
Oh my gosh. I was, my mom, my nickname when I was a kid was Little Professor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I would always have answers for everything.
Uh-huh.
Because my mom would ask me, well, what's that? And I'd go off and just tell her what I thought it was and figured that that was the answer to the question or whatever.
Even as a little guy?
Yeah, as a little guy. I was always... And it was funny because later on in life, I was very shy. I was a very shy kid until my late teens out of high school and stuff. But through skating, you kind of have to get rid of that shyness. But when I was really little, that was called a little professor. I was into everything. I was very much a loner. I only had a few close friends, very mm-hmm. few. Loved to kind of do my own adventures, and Star Wars was my thing, and I'd do role-playing and thought I was Luke Skywalker or Han Solo, and we had a big farm, and we lived on a farm. We had 50 acres, and I grew up with all the animals there and learned a lot about dogs and cats and chickens and horses and all of that sort of stuff. So I was always around that, and hence the dirt bike, and, you know, being around that type of environment was quite healthy for me as a young kid.
So Luke Skywalker, that tells me that you were sort of a protector kind of person and a bit of an adventurer and kind of a... did it say anything about you, do you think? Or did you play... Were you Darth Vader as well?
No, I was
never
always...
Never the evil guy?
No, never the evil guy. I always wanted to kick his ass. But I was... yeah, you could say that. I was always into... loved playing the hero, loved being the guy that... the adventurer, you mm-hmm. know, and it was never always the easy way. It was always the tough way, kind of have to, you know, fight your way through things and learn that. I always found you learn the most through that, you know, through life.
So did you have an active inner life? Did you live a lot in your head? Were you somebody that, like, expressed themselves through poetry or movement even as a little child? Or was it through, imagination games? Like, what was it like?
Imagination, that was a big thing for me. I always loved, I'll give you an example. I still remember this. We had an above ground pool, and my parents eventually wanted to get an in-ground pool. So we had it moved, and then they started digging for the in-ground pool back in the day. And they had these huge mounds of dirt. They were mountains for me. I was a little guy. And I went out there, and there was, like, still wet, unused chunks of cement.
Okay.
So I would go and I built a pretend, like, X-Wing fighter or a snow speeder from, like, Star Wars. And I would pretend I was, like, the guy flying the
plane.
One
of the pilots?
And I was by myself. And I would do this. And then I had another friend from kindergarten, and he'd come over. His name was Paul Farr. And he lived on another farm. His they had a big farm. They had, like, a professional farm. We had kind of like a hobby farm. But we were friends, and we became friends, best friends in kindergarten. And he'd come over, and we'd always do the same thing. We'd play, you know, role playing and stuff, and play army guys, and always enjoyed doing that. That was the thing. And also we had a big, huge barn. And it was we had an old home. Right now, I think it's actually, they can't tear it down because it's historical. It's
one
so
of those
old.
Heritage homes.
Yeah. And my parents bought it at the time. I think it was already 80 or 100 years old at the time, back in the late 60s. And there was a huge barn on it. And that's where we would have the hay bales put in there. And we would climb up on the rafters and jump, like, you know, 15, 20 feet off into the big, we'd open up a few of the hay bales and we'd jump in there and have fun, you know, tootling around in there and always had adventures, always wanted to play a character. And it was always about that. And that's why I love movies so much, and adventure movies and science fiction and that. And you know, my brother would come home every once in a while. They were much older. My siblings, 14 and 12 years older, and they'd come back and he had a little dirt bike at the time. I was too young at the time, a little mini bike, and I slowly got into that. And my neighbor used to race dirt bikes and have races at his house. And we lived on the top of a hill, and the driveway came down and then on an L shape. And I used to sit on the top corner, and I could see the track, and I used to go there and watch mm-hmm. all the time. And I'd go
How
down.
How old were you?
I probably was about, at the time, probably about 5, 6 years old.
Oh, okay.
And I used to go down there and watch. And I used to watch them race. And I remember once, Frankie Watts was his name, and he invited me down once, and I came to look and everything. And interestingly enough, Mitzi Watts, I used to call Mrs. Watts, the mom, was the lady that actually helped my mom find an arena for me to skate, because my mom had no idea how to get me in skating, because I wanted to skate when I was 2.5.
How did she know you wanted to skate? Like, how did you express that?
Well, I was watching television at about 2.5 years old, and I think someone was skating, and I believe it might have been, I don't know if it was Kay Thompson at the time, might have been before her time, but someone was spinning anyways. And I just told my mom I wanted to do that, and they didn't take me for the longest time because it was sort of, I was into everything. I wanted to be everything, do everything. So I was, you know, outside in rubber boots playing the guitar on a tennis racket and singing. My mom has these like reel to reel tapes that we converted, and I would watch and I laughed. I was always trying to be the center of attention. But finally they took me when I was 4 years old of constant nagging, and my mom didn't have any idea anything about skating. So she went to the neighbor, Mrs. Watts, and she said, well, why don't we go to Newmarket, and I think there's an arena there and we could sign him up and find out, you know, more information. Sure. And from there I got signed up there, and eventually the skating went from, you know, wintertime can skate at the time. It wasn't called can skate, but beginner skate, and got my badges, you know, and then eventually it started to progress.
How many little boys were in figure skating when you were a little boy?
There were two.
I was going to say, because, you know, the Learn to Skate programs now are filled with boy children that want to learn how to play hockey.
Yeah.
But back in the day, mm-hmm. Learn to Skate programs were primarily for figure skaters, not for children who wanted to go on and do speed skating or hockey or anything mm-hmm. else.
No.
So you and another boy.
Yeah, there was two of us, and then eventually there was a few more, probably maybe 4 or 5 guys in total. Later on, as probably the next year, the year after, there were a few more from other clubs came, and they would kind of guest skate once in a while, and we would do our, you know, our club carnivals. I would play a puppy dog or the Incredible Hulk or whatever, and there was a group of guys. There was the one group of just the boys, right?
That's right.
And then all the other girls and just the boys, right? And it's funny, the story, I've told this story before. I might have told you about this, my first competition.
I was going to ask you to tell that first story because I love it.
Yeah, it's a funny story. I mean, back then I was still too young. We weren't doing programs, so to speak. I didn't have a program, but I was still doing edges and things. So we had this competition, and because there's only two boys competing and there was like probably 30 girls, they just put us all together. So we would do like just outside edges, very like
the elements almost.
Elements,
eh?
Yeah, or the precursor to figures.
Yeah,
basically, right. So we do edges and things like that, and I guess they didn't think that a boy would win the competition, so they didn't have any, you know, trophies, because the trophies had a little girl on it. Well, I ended up winning, so I have this little trophy of a little girl on, you know, on the
little statue, the little in the statue,
yeah, in the straight skating dress with the Dorothy Hamill hair. Right?
That's special.
So, and I have it somewhere. My mom has it. We have it packed away, but I still have that 1970-something. Yeah.
You should pull it out onto the mantle. I mean, seriously.
Oh, that for sure. For sure. It's got my name on it. I think Elvis Stoiko, and then it is like, it's so funny.
So I want to go actually to your first international competition. Also a very funny story.
Mm-hmm.
You told me about the draw. Do you remember that story?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. That one's a good
yeah,
one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was fun. It was great because I got invited to, and I just was talking to the singer here, Marcus, about it, but I was invited I was an alternate to my very first international, and it was a junior, considered be a junior Grand Prix. And back then they didn't have very many
right.
of them. There was maybe one or two. And it was called Blue Swords, and it was in East Berlin, East Germany, back then before the wall was taken down. And I was invited there. I was an alternate, but they had the money to send me. So I went.
The association.
The association,
did.
Yeah. CFSA at the time. And I was like, oh, it's a great opportunity. So we went, and at the draw, I'm looking up, you know, I'm dressed up. And at the time, I was very shy at that point. Very, very shy. I was a very quiet kid. Around my close friends, I was crazy. But around, like, the group, I was very quiet.
And grown-ups, too.
Oh, absolutely. I was afraid to even open my mouth. And there I was sitting. We were doing the draw. I was dressed in my tie and the whole thing. And I'm looking up at the group, the list of names, and there was old school, so they would have literally moved the name from one slide to the other slide by hand and put them in order. And I'm looking, and I can't find my name.
And which I'm is like, disconcerting if yeah! you're competing.
And I'm like, so I'm like, okay, I'm looking, okay, I'll look over at the countries, because our countries are listed. So I'm looking, and there's okay, Canada, and there's the one competitor, and then I look down, Canada, and there's the other, I'm like, Alvin Stikey? Alvin, not even close to my name, right? And I'm like, oh my God, this is embarrassing. So I'm like, what am I going to do, right? So finally, I'm realizing that's my name. So I get called up for my draw, my position for the, you know, for the short program. And I go up there from Canada, Alvin Steike. So I go up there, and it was a German lady, and I forgot her name. She was a sweetheart. She was on the technical panel for years, and I forgot her name. But anyways, we became good friends many years later anyways. But I get up there, and she's Alvin Steike. And I got up there, and I walked over to her, and I was trying to be, like, very discreet. But how do you do that in front of her? I kind of leaned over, and I went, Elvis Stoiko. Right? And she looked at me, and she's like, What was that?
What is that?
And I'm like, oh God, it's Elvis Stoiko. Elvis Stoiko? Oh, Alvin Steike, no, Elvis Stoiko. How do you spell? And I'm like, oh no.
Everybody's looking at
me. And everyone's like, and everyone's kind of giggling now, right? So finally, I'm like, no, it's not A, it's E, 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 L, V. And I'm like, and I'm trying to spell out my name for her. Finally, through that, I'm sweating. Finally, we get through all of that embarrassment. I pick my number to skate and everything, but it was so funny. And the team leader knew because Doug couldn't even go with me at the time. He had other competition.
Doug Lee, your coach.
Yeah, Doug Lee, my coach at the time. He couldn't come with me. So we had, I think it was Kathy Matusik.
Yep.
That went with us as a team leader, and Doug asked her to kind of look after me.
Sure.
So I was there. My mom came, so I didn't feel completely, you know, by myself.
Mrs. Steike.
Yeah, Mrs. Steike. And it was great because that competition, I was the alternate, but I ended up beating the guy that they sent for Ooh. Canada. He ended up seventh, and I ended up third. And this was amazing because the group of guys there was the first competition for guys like Philippe Candeloro. That was the first time we competed against each other. We were both like 14 or 15 wow. years old. Ronnie Winkler from Germany back yep. in the day. Many people knew him. Oleg Tatarov, another mm-hmm. great Russian skater. There was a group of skaters, probably five or six of us, that had gone and competed many years later as seniors for many years. But that was our first competition together. And Ronnie Winkler won. Philippe was second and I was third. And wow. it was really, really cool. And I still remember it.
So at what point, I mean, you're somebody that people, somebody said to me once that your name is probably the most widely recognized. It's one of the most widely searched names on Google as far as figure skating is concerned. And just as far as being sort of a human in the world and a well-known one. Mm. So at what point do you know, A, that you're good at skating, and B, that you're famous now?
I think when I kind of figured out that I had a talent and I could do something with it, I was about eight or nine years old, and I was still skating in Newmarket, and the coach I was working with had told my parents, you know, this, your son has talent and he's gonna have to think about going to a club that has better, like a stronger group sure. of skaters. You know, Newmarket was sort of club level
sure.
at the time. Great place. They had a great group of coaches. Like, I work with, Steven Sugar.
Oh yeah.
You know, and stay, I see him now, and he was actually, when I was doing my level one, he was the coach that came to watch me do class.
A lesson?
And okay. it was really kind of neat, you know, and it was neat. And Ann Broughton and many different coaches I work with. And that was when I went and started skating in the Toronto Cricket Club.
Yep.
And I started working with Ellen Burka. And within, you know, I showed up there with a weak single axel. Like, I had talent, but it was very raw. A weak single axel at 9, 10 years old, which is nothing to write home about. And within 2 years, I was already doing double axel and two triples.
Wow.
2.5 years later. And it started progressing quickly from that point. It was my work ethic, because I was very focused on whatever I pictured I could do, I would go and I would do it. And that was that time. The other side, I think, when I became famous, so to speak, I think...
Or aware of it.
Aware, yep. Well, really, well, it was the same, exactly the same time. But I was going Junior Worlds 1989, going into the 1990 season, back when Junior Worlds was in December yep. instead of in March. And I competed at Junior Worlds, and I was just getting triple axel at the time, and I landed it for the first time there in practice and everything, and it was weird. I had trained for a couple of years. I was a junior champion 2 years earlier. Didn't make the nationals in senior. Had a rough year. Went through some very growth spurts and just a tough time in skating. I lost my jumps, lost my timing, I gained weight. I started getting muscles, and it changed a lot of things at that age at 16. Next year, things started to settle in. competed at a few internationals, did okay, nothing special. And for some, right around that time in December, something clicked. All the training, all the frustration, all the tears and blood, sweat, and everything else came to fruition. And I got this triple axel, and it was consistent. And back then, that was a big deal. I was only 17, and I started doing quads as well, quad toe loops. And
you went to Worlds in 1990.
Yeah, and 3 months later, I went, and even Kurt says this, I outskated him at Nationals. I came out of nowhere, and I did everything.
He said it behind your back, too, just so you know.
Yeah, I know.
He doesn't say it to you, he says it about you, too, when you're not there.
Yeah, no, he talked to me about it, and we had a chat on tour about it. He says, yeah, that was a... And I told him, I said, well, it was weird because it would have been weird for me to win it that year. I was so shy. It would have been tough to handle. So it was a little bit easier still to be in his shadow. But I went to Worlds, and it was interestingly enough, December at Junior Worlds, I placed eighth.
So this is 89.
89. Yep. And then in March of 1990, skated clean in Halifax, I placed ninth at Worlds.
Wow.
And I was sixth in the long program in my first Worlds, 17 years old.
I remember it.
And that was when that's when people went, holy crap, especially from Nationals to Worlds within 3 months. The next big jump, the next year, landing the quad double would put me on the map. And then the big one was...
I was there for that one, too.
Yeah, in Munich. And 92 was the big one.
Yeah.
That was when I skated the only clean and short and long in the whole event at Olympics in the men's. And I dropped the placing. And then the country went nuts. Don Cherry went ballistic. He was a huge supporter of my skating and of me. I became friends with him, and he really went to town on national television during a hockey game. He was like, I gotta tell you something, you know, and he just went off, and everyone's telling me about Don Cherry, what he said. And I actually talked to Don while I was in France back in the day and talked to him. And I was like, oh my God, I heard what you said. And that's when it really took off, and people got to know me internationally. And then, you know, a month later, I went to Worlds and placed third, where, you know, I should have placed, you know. And it was really a blessing in disguise, you know, because I could have got what I deserved at Olympics that year, and it would have been, great, he got what he deserved, okay, on to the next.
Yeah.
But because it was such a controversy, people just didn't want to let it go. They were a dog with a bone. And it stuck, and then it was just something that kind of built that sort of reputation around me, and it started to grow. And, you know, there were some positive things out of it and some negative things I had to fight along the way, but it created who I was and the way people saw me.
So do you think, I've been thinking as we've been talking about shyness, the whole idea of being able to impose a character as a shy child, to be able to assume a character, did that help you bridge the gap between shy little boy and sort of confident young man? That idea of you know, assuming a character until you could...
Yeah, there's many different heroes in the sport of skating that I looked up to, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, guys like, you know, Kurt, of course, and Brian Orser, who I trained with, Joseph Sabovchik, Scotty Hamilton, Alexander Fadeev, even guys like Rudy Cherney. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of people know guys like that. He was a phenomenal skater. You know, beautiful lines, and that's where I got the sit spin from.
Oh, really?
That long leg sit spin, because it was just something I remember in his skating. And through all of that, I still was trying to find who I was on the ice. And that's why from like 1990 to like about 92-ish, 93, it was still a time for me being developed. I was still young, 17 to 19, 20.
Sure.
Because I just didn't do what people, they would give me a style, and then you go with the style, and I see that a lot. And yeah, you can get away with it, and it looks nice.
Yeah.
But I look at it and I go, yeah, they just did it because someone told them to do it. And I wasn't like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And you can't push me to make me do something else in the meantime,
mm-hmm.
because I just wasn't comfortable, you know, with doing something else. And I was still trying to search for that thing, that part of me, because I just didn't skate or look like anyone else in the sport.
Yeah.
You know, I had the only closest one that I had a combination with, really, is the jumping style of Brian Boitano, who... you know, I skated with many years, became a really good friend of mine. And then the body style of Alexander Fadeev.
Yeah.
And I was trying to find out who I was, but I was looking always externally, trying to find it, until, you know, with the martial arts and working with my instructor, who I met, interestingly enough, that year that I had a breakthrough in 1989 to 1990, mm-hmm. I met my instructor. I already had a black belt in karate, and then I switched to kung fu, which doesn't have a belt system. Many people confuse it and say I have a black belt in kung fu, but kung fu doesn't have a belt system.
Oh, what do they have?
It's a sash. It's like younger brother, older brother,
okay.
And then sifu, right? It's a different level because it's a different philosophy in the way they grade. And I met Glenn Doyle, and I started through my brother, and I was looking for another type of martial arts. I was getting very stale where I was. And I met Glenn through my brother, and he did a form for me, and I knew right away that's what I wanted to learn. It was very fluid, and mm-hmm. it wasn't stiff. It had this power, but it was fluid. And it reminded me of Bruce Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a lot of stuff on Bruce, and I read his books and all that, and I ended up meeting his widow at one
did
point,
you really?
Too. Yeah, and she sent me stuff. Yeah,
wow.
Linda Lee Caldwell, her name now, but she sent me stuff and signed some things for me. I met, which was phenomenal, after I did the Bruce Lee story to honor Bruce. And I met Glenn, and I started training with him, and within a few months, that was the secret weapon that changed my skating, was this friendship, which I still have to this day. He's mm-hmm. he's my best friend. He's my instructor, my teacher, my just confidant. Like, we became brothers, and that was the secret weapon that changed. And at the time, I didn't know it, because it was just something I was doing. He was training me, and it would just, he knew movement so well. And then it progressed year after year. And then right at that time in 1993, the Bruce Lee story came out. Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. I went to see the movie, and the music played, and I was like,
I love that music.
The music was so powerful. Yeah. And I was like, oh, this is me. This is what I have to do. And I knew right away. And then I would play with some things on the ice, with like techno hip hop things, mm-hmm. and like popping and all this, you know, and I was starting to get into that type of music, and Ushi said, let's do it. Let's do this for Olympic year. This is you. Let's do this. So we played for hours. I put on music, and I just would just skate, just improv stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then Glenn helped me with the program for the Bruce Lee story, and I worked with another martial artist at the time, but Glenn was the one that really helped me with the stuff, and we created the program and put things together, and it started to open up, and I started to feel who I was. It was, you know, and everyone thought, oh, he only skates to martial arts stuff, and he only does martial art movements. I only did a martial art program twice, 1994 and 2002. The 1998 program had a flavor of it, but it wasn't it. But everyone associates it with martial arts, right? Because, oh, he's a martial artist, blah, blah, blah. But it was part of who I was, because it's a philosophy, not so much just a physical way of moving stylistically. And that's where I opened up, where the onion unveiled and the flower opened up. And I was like, that's where it was. And it was raw. Like, mm-hmm. I opened up and I was raw. And I was like, now I'm going to have to take the real criticism. But this is me. And I took the shots, and people were saying, oh, that's not skating. And got a letter from a guy after Olympics saying, you know, that was, you should stick to what skating is. If you can't skate, you shouldn't skate. Martial arts, boring to the point of nausea. You're lucky you even won the silver. Like,
for real?
Yeah, yeah. It was unbelievable. And that's where I was learning the negative side and the positive side, and learned how to have a thick skin. And you know, people are going to have opinions about things, but you have to be honest to yourself and skate truthfully, skate who you are. And that was the unveiling. It took some time, you know, because I just didn't want people to put things on me,
mm-hmm.
you know, to make, garnish it up, garnish the plate to make it look good so it fits. But deep down, there's no meat and potatoes. There's no essence. I mm-hmm. couldn't do that. So I was developing. I was sort of that morphing jello at the time. And then 93, 94, it just started to open up. And that's when it unveiled itself.
When somebody attacks you, I mean, what I say this about you behind your back, I appreciate your candor. I appreciate your honesty. I appreciate the fact that if I ask you a question, you'll answer it. Doesn't necessarily mean that we have to agree, but it means that you're willing to be truthful enough about what you believe to share it.
Mm.
When somebody attacks you, how, with your work through Glenn Doyle, how have you been able to respond to negativity? How do you process it?
I've processed it different over the years, and we all make mistakes. So we always, and I look at it, mistakes are just, you learn the way not to do something. They're not bad things. Mm-hmm. They're just something you learn from. And you have to look at it in a positive way. And I used to first react, I wouldn't react at all. I would just sort of eat it all and just not say anything.
Stuff it down.
Stuff it down. And over a period of time, you're going to boil and you're going to snap.
Yeah.
And then I started snapping at the time when I was younger. I would just let things out at weird times. I'm like, what the heck? At weird times, it would just come out. It's kind of like,
you're at the grocery store and it's inappropriate.
Yeah, it's just weird. Or like, you see it happen with a married couple. It's building, and then the plate drops. Oh my God, what the heck? And they snap over a plate. But it's not the plate. It's something that happened a month ago.
Sure.
And Glenn was like, dude. And Glenn is the person that he's so honest and upfront, and he was the one guy that just said it like it was to me, and he didn't tell me things that I needed to hear. He told me, thought I needed to hear. He would tell me the truth.
Yeah.
Hurt or not, he would tell me the truth. And he'd say things about people. I go, that person supports you. That person's going to stab your back. And he would point many people out. And there was probably out of 50 people, three of them that were good. And the rest,
was he right about
them? He pegged them all. And that's why he had trouble within the sport sometimes, because they knew that he knew about them.
Yeah.
And he knew the snipers in the grass. You couldn't trick him. And he would always watch my back. And he said, Elvis, dude, it's going to come a time when you're going to have to make waves. And you're going to have to do it. And in skating, I know it's tough, because you have to play this sort of, you have to be very conservative.
Middle ground
sometimes, and be the, the diplomat in a way. But sometimes for your own essence, for your own being, you're going to have to stand up and say it. And it took time to be able to have courage to do that, because it took time just to be able to talk to people.
Sure.
And then open up, and then also not, just sort of learn that confidence in yourself. And then eventually when someone says something, go, hey, man, that's not cool. You know what I mean? And I would, I eventually started doing that. Yeah. I ended up started making a few enemies at first, but then people were like, you know what? I like him because he says what he feels, and he defends himself. He defends himself, but not in a way that's like backing up. No, I'm like, dude, no, that's wrong, and that's bull crap. And
here's the line.
Here's the line.
Yep.
Right, and that's the way it's going to be. And this discussion is like, there's lots of stuff that had gone on, and I know there's bantering with taller Cranston people that we have this bantering thing going all the time. He always says stuff because I just wasn't the type of skater that he liked. Right, it was just the way he was, and there was a lot of that banter going back and forth. My mom hated that. She just, oh,
Her baby.
Yeah, I hate that guy. He always puts you down. And da-da-da-da-da. He's just jealous because of this. And I'm like, Mom, I know. He's just, I'm not his type of skater.
Yeah.
Right? It's just he likes something else. And it was a stigma that was tough because he started saying things on TV, and then people would pick it up. Because they just watch it and just sort of pick it up and go, oh, he's a jumper. Because it's hard to attack someone that, when you don't make a lot of mistakes, okay, how can we put him down in a way, okay, we'll use this angle, right? Because he doesn't fit the mold and he doesn't look like Brian or Kurt. We can do this, right? And that was the thing I had to fight a lot, and that was the whole thing. And yeah, you could fight that, but just, you might not have to like my skating, but, as a person, you're going to respect me.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And you're going to respect what I've done and what I'm doing. And that was a thing where I had to, that was a thing about martial arts that I learned to stand up for yourself. And that was how I approached skating as a martial artist. And that's when I had the talk with, had a nice chat with Patrick this year. And he's been talking about it. And it's kind of cool because I've been getting interviews over, hey, I heard you talk to Patrick and he came to you. And he came to me quite a bit over the tour I did.
We're talking Patrick Chan, for those that don't know.
Yeah, Patrick Chan. And we were talking and stuff. And And I know people will tell Patrick what, you know, because he's Patrick, they're going to say things to him, what they think he needs to hear. But I'll tell Patrick what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he, and I didn't know how he was going to react, because he said, you know, he wanted some advice. And I said to him, I said, dude, you're an easy target. If I was competing against you, you're an easy target. And he looked at me and he's like, what do you mean? I said, you try to win every practice. He goes, yeah, I know. I said, I'd have you jumping yourself silly all week. And by the time the week's over, you'd be all done. And I could take you, because you've already spent your wad the whole week.
Wow.
And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, that's kind of, yeah. And you could see, like, because I knew, and I'm like, yeah, I could peg you right away. Yeah, I could read him, because it's a martial artist thing. You just learn to read people, right? And I said, and I was wondering, okay, is he going to come back to me for more advice? Sure enough, he did. Because I told him not what people think you should hear, because he's sure. Patrick Chan. I don't care if you're Patrick Chan. You're still a dude learning.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you what I think. If you're going to come to me for advice, I'm going to tell you what I think. You know, that's what you want. I respect you, so I'm going to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You can say I don't agree with it or not, but at least I give you my point of view. And he came to me a number of times, and he was like, yeah, that makes sense. I said, dude, just prepare for the competition. Don't waste all your energy. And I said, I approach skating as a martial artist, not as a skater. That was my secret.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm passing that on to you, man. Like, and think about it. Use it.
Okay, Paul. So that's a very good example of what I was talking about with Elvis. The fact that you ask him a question, he's willing to answer it. He's willing to share details about his life and about his ideas and about where he comes from. I really thought that it gave me a great deal of insight. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with you, and I think he does like to talk, and that's why we do have another whole episode of part two with Elvis.
And I am looking forward to it, and I bet you will be too. Now, if you want to get a hold of us, how do we do it, Paul?
You go to our website, openkwongdoor.com, or follow us on Twitter at openkwongdoor, or email us at contact@openkwongdoor.com.
Okay, it has to be said. Have we received any emails yet?
We have lots of emails, yes.
Do we?
Yes.
I've never seen even one. He's clearly our administrator, and I don't have the password. That's all for now, folks.